afternoon, we are delighted to welcome students from Mid-State Technical School. Would they please stand so we can meet them? Thank you. You may be seated. Students come to the court to listen to oral argument, and they have been invited here as part of a national award-winning program that is cleverly entitled Court with Class. Students come and listen to oral argument. They may have been given materials about this case. They have may have engaged in some activities relating to this case. And the ones that came in the morning usually stay for lunch. Did these students come meet with you at lunch?
No, they weren't here, Chief.
Okay. Then I'll make the offer now. If you can stay, we'll get a justice to come out right after the argument and talk with the students about the way the court takes cases and decides cases, but not about the substantive issues of this case. So having said that, does anyone here need a summary of the case we're about to hear? If you raise your right hand, we'll give you a summary. Let me introduce the court to all of you. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. She was the assigned judge today. Are you willing to do that?
Absolutely.
Justice? She will meet with you afterwards if you can meet with her.
If they're able, I'm willing.
All right. we got a deal. Seated next to Justice Bradley is Justice David Prosser, and on the far right of the bench is Justice Annette Ziegler. Starting on the far left of the bench is Justice Michael Gableman. Seated next to him is Justice Patience Robinsack, and to my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. With those introductions made, I'll call our case for the afternoon, 09AP284D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Alan D. Eisenberg. Arguing on behalf of himself is Alan D. Eisenberg. Mr. Eisenberg, you have 25 minutes, and you may proceed.
May it please the court. Mr. Schwarzenbach. I had hopes that this might be my last appearance before this court. I first came here in 1965, the last time I was here representing a litigant was about 10 years ago. I represented the owner of a dog, and this court reversed the lower court, and I went back to the lower court to represent the interests of the dog. It sure is great to appear in this courtroom today and see a dog in the lower left-hand corner of this picture to the justices. Right, I'm sure that was done in my honor. Not only am I back here because of a case arising in 1999, again, representing a dog, it appears that today I am the dog. Now, the lower courts in the old case found that my pursuit of justice on behalf of a dog was frivolous. But the Court of Appeals ruled that it wasn't frivolous, and this court did not sustain any finding of frivolousness there. That was City of Racine versus Rabideau. So here I am now, back in front of you. The 1999 case results in a finding that I acted frivolously. How sad. The prosecution, Mr. Schwarzenbart, and especially the referee, knew from the earliest proceedings in this matter that my health was failing terribly. A circuit court has entered a finding that I'm 100% disabled, can barely walk. Actually, I discovered last week that my heart is in bad trouble. I wasn't even sure that I would survive. Today, having sciatica pains shooting down my right leg while I'm talking. But the worst part about all of this has been the trauma that these nonstop proceedings caused me. You know, I'm not the only person in the world who has felt that he or she was falsely accused. There have even been Supreme Court justices who thought they were falsely accused and made accusations back against their accuser that the accuser was making a false accusation. And here I am. Now, this court has allowed all proceedings against me to continue in perpetuity. It's a matter of record in this court that Mr. Salen's office has 9 more cases that he says he intends to proceed on if I ever apply for the practice of law again. I cannot, because of severe health issues, continue practicing law. I cannot practice law anymore. I can't walk. I can't walk to courts. Before my practice folded, courts were allowing me to not rise for a judge or jury and not stand the way I'm obligated to do today because of my...
So if you prefer to be seated, we can give you a microphone.
That would be a blessing.
All right, please be seated. We'll set you up with a microphone.
Well, I can move it. Should I just move it to the table?
No, we'll take care of it, sir. Just...
If you're wondering why I have my...
Tina, you may want to reposition his lights, too, so he can see them.
I'll leave them
they
bay.
Don't turn.
I will advise you when your 5 minutes break signal is up.
No, just leave it be. Let's not... We've had enough problems today.
If you're wondering why I haven't removed my coat, it's because I'm freezing. My hands are way below... room temperature. They're like ice. My feet are like ice. My heart doesn't pump blood to my extremities anymore. Since the revocation of my license, the disbarment occurred, I've been in terrible shape mentally. Since that month, right through until last Thursday, and which will include one of the days after today, I've been in, and this is a matter of record, I've been in psychotherapy, trying to fight off the ravages of suicide. it would have made it so much simpler for this court if I had succeeded. I don't expect any sympathy or pity. I am not a victim, but I sure as heck know when I've been getting victimized. And I've learned in the last 3 years that does not make me a victim. It may make me a scapegoat, but it doesn't make me a victim. I'm not a victim. I don't want to be a victim. I don't want to be a cremated victim. I just want to be a cremated Ellen. That's all part of the record also. I am totally puzzled why this court has allowed the posture of the prosecution that they can proceed on 9 more cases. I answered all of the allegations fully. They said that they would not allow me a hearing and opposed my request for a hearing on all of them. And
counsel, Mr. Eisenberg.
Yes, ma'am.
Those other communications you're talking about, are they before the court now?
Yes, they are.
Why?
I even brought a motion to compel them to proceed or quit, and then I had that reviewed by this court, and this court denied that request.
So
it's before this court.
When the court denies a motion, it's ordinarily the end. The reason I'm talking to you about that is we do have 2 matters that are before the court. And perhaps we should talk about those.
I'm prepared to do that, but this is part of that discussion.
Okay. You may proceed then.
The point I'm making is that I appear to have been prejudged. And with respect to the 2 matters, I have again, for the 3rd or 4th time in my life, been adjudged by a referee, but this was the worst experience I ever had. The record does not reflect volume, tone, attitude, but without a doubt, this was the worst experience I've ever had in my life with any judge. For some reason in his findings, he said the same about me. The difference is that I showed up every time. And on one occasion, he didn't even show up, knowing what pain it caused me to get to court and what trauma it had. He knew I was suicidal. He even adjourned one proceeding because I was so rattled I couldn't think. I may be having a hard time with that today, thinking. So he adjourned the case because he knew I was in treatment for suicide, and that is in the record. But he got more abusive, and that's reflected in the record. And then he didn't even show up. A judge who didn't show up at all. Now, that was unforgivable. My office tried to find him, but was told that they were instructed not to talk to me. Mr. Schwarzenbart located him. He apologized to Mr. Schwarzenbart, but not to me. I was the one who had to sit there for well over an hour in agony, and he didn't show up. Then I asked for a hearing. Then I moved to recuse him, and he refused to recuse, and I asked for a hearing on it with the power to call witnesses. The reason he said he didn't come is because he had an emergency involving the nursing home. As soon as I learned that, I called and offered to subpoena the witnesses in. I contacted the nursing home authorities here in Madison and I made a clear record on this. In the two cases, he had no emergency, none whatsoever. There just wasn't any excuse, and it was a lie. And he didn't like that, that I proved that he had lied. My costs for his research about whether he should recuse went through the ceiling. He was clearly biased, isn't the word for it. He was enraged that I had caught him. I still wish I could get a hearing on it. And of course, I filed a judicial commission complaint, and they did what they always do with my complaints, ignored it, didn't even respond. Something is wrong here. The system went awry in my case. He never should have been allowed, and still should not be allowed, to make a decision, especially one that stands. In my appeal, I contend that the charges against me should be dismissed. And I assert, among other things, that those charges are insubstantial and should not be the basis for any additional discipline. Charges regarding the euthanasia of the dog occurred prior to the revocation of my license, and therefore should not give rise to additional discipline beyond the existing revocation. This referee appears to have had no authority whatsoever to extend my revocation or time within which I can apply for reinstatement. I have no intention of ever applying for reinstatement. I do not want to be a lawyer anymore. I'm a nothing. I am a zero. I'm barely alive. To say the least, I don't want to practice law. I do not want to practice law. 50 years is enough. I have lived for the law for 50 years. I'm done.
Mr. Eisenberg.
Yes.
In view of the fact that you have been revoked.
That I have been?
That you have been revoked.
Yes.
And that you don't want to practice law because of your health and other reasons. Why don't you just, I mean, why have you extended the effort to resist these particular charges?
I offered to surrender my license, and OLR said only if I confess to the other 9 charges.
I mean, beyond what is here?
Oh, yes. We're talking about 9 more, where Mr. Sellin, who has prosecuted me every year since he joined OLR as the chief, every single year, I offered to surrender my license to attempt to avoid these proceedings today. I offer it again now. Overrule them. And by the way, all of these proceedings have pauperized me. I don't have a way of making a living practicing law. The only thing that I've ever done for 50 years. I don't own my own home anymore. After working like a dog for 50 years. Oh, excuse me. That must have been that dog. I've worked like a dog my whole life, putting in long hours helping people. At least I think I tried to help people. I offer again to this court now. Take the license. I surrender. And obliterate the outrageous costs that were the result of vexatious litigation. And I mean vexatious. By every measure of vexatiousness, 44 exhibits offered against me, all cumulative. At the hearing, 44 of them. I And I audit curriculum at the University of Wisconsin. At my advanced age, I can do it for free. And I discovered an ancient precedent for a prosecution like this. It's the people versus Sisamnes, S-I-S-A-M-N-E-S. The Sisamnes, strangely enough, resembles me. The prosecution was Cambyses, C-A-M-B-Y-S-E-S. And the prosecutor was entitled under the law in that country in 551 A.D. to strip the flesh of Sisamnes from his body in public. Well, isn't that what we're doing here? They're stripping my flesh. I don't want a license. Take my license today. Don't deliberate. Just take my license. So, there's the answer. This is hardly a resistance. Isn't further discipline to me a foregone conclusion here? That's a question. As soon as I show up, I can expect to be hammered. So here I am. Sounds masochistic, doesn't it? That's what prompted the question. Am I a masochist? I guess. Take the license. It means nothing to me anymore.
Well, what would have happened if you had not participated in the disciplinary hearing? You had just defaulted, for example. I mean, there are multiple issues here, multiple charges, but two matters. Then there's the issue of the extension on the revocation, and then there's $25,000 in costs.
Mm-hmm.
You've got 50 years of experience. Attack one of those directly in a way that we could come to grips with it.
I don't have $30,000 to pay, and by the time Mr. Schwarzenbart is done with me, it'll be closer to 35. I don't have that money at all. I don't have it. I don't have a job. I'm unemployable. And this referee's decision was conceived in iniquity. It's lasted 5 times the normal gestation period, and it has resulted in an uproarious abortion that lived with 9 more to go. You say, what happens if I defaulted? If you read the record, and you're one of the few that I know will read it, the transcript, you'll see that when Mr. Schwarzenbart argued, this is the most guilty respondent that ever existed, or words to that effect, I said, issue summary judgment against me. It's a civil proceeding. Why don't you issue a summary judgment? Issue judgment on the pleadings. Which you wouldn't do.
Well, counsel, is that what you're asking this court to do? That's one way of hearing Justice Prosser's question.
I don't understand the question. I understand it in part, but I'm not sure I got it all.
Well,
is what I'm asking this court to do?
Yeah, what are you asking this court to do? And your orange light is on, so you have about 4 minutes.
You know as well as I do, very much so, that if I applied for reinstatement at age in my late 70s, this court wouldn't allow it anyway. There are a lot of people who apply for reinstatement and don't get reinstated. And you would issue a decision recounting all my past failures and not reinstate me. This court would always have the discretion to not reinstate me. The point is moot. Take the license. These outrageous costs resulted from an unfair proceeding. anything I did would just trigger the beginning of 9 more. I couldn't give up my license without enduring 9 more, all of which were unjust and defensible. So it's a catch-22. Yes, take my license again and again and again. Take it 9 times more. Revoke me till I die. If there's a discipline, it should be concurrent. At worst, at best, it should be dismissed. There should be a time and a purpose to things. What is the purpose of coming after me and cranking up again right after I'm disbarred? Because it's one way of traumatizing me and pushing me into an early grave. That's the purpose. There can be no other. When you know somebody's suicidal, why would you keep going after them unless you want them to die? Tell me to die and I'll do it. Order a lobotomy. I surrender.
Mr. Eisenberg, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal after you hear from Mr. Schwarzenbach.
Can I sit the row behind me?
You may if you wish, or you may sit right there. If you prefer someone to sit with you, they can come and sit with you. Either way you prefer.
May it please the court, Paul Schwarzenbart of Madison, Wisconsin. I have the honor to represent the Office of Lawyer Regulation here today in this disciplinary proceeding. This matter comes before the court on the appeal of Mr. Eisenberg from the report and recommendation of the referee, John Decker. Attorney Decker practiced law honorably for many years in the city of Milwaukee. He produced a detailed report and recommendation in this case in excess of 50 pages. The report finds that the OLR had sustained its burden of proof on each of the 5 claims for discipline at issue in this proceeding. The referee recommended an extension for 2 years from April 1, 2015, of the date upon which Mr. Eisenberg would otherwise be eligible to apply for reinstatement to the bar. Following the 5-year period from when his license was revoked by this court in disciplinary proceedings against Eisenberg 2010-11.
Counsel?
Yes.
I'm concerned about the OLR starting what is to me a bit of a new procedure. I'm concerned about, is this the best route to try to take the court? As I understand it, with regard to the dog matter, you know, that stuff all happened before, I think, even the filing of the last proceeding. Am I correct or incorrect on that?
The first 3 counts of the dog matter, Your Honor. The case was commenced, I believe, in the year, it may have been late 1999 or late 2000.
Yeah.
It was concluded in 2001, the appeal was dismissed in 2002. Mr. Eisenberg then filed a motion to reopen in 2006, which was denied by the court and affirmed on appeal in 2007.
My concern is, why weren't some of these matters brought before the court in the last proceeding here of his discipline, which resulted in revocation?
And Justice Bradley, I'm probably not the person who would be able to answer that question for the OLR because I'm a retained counsel. I'm not there.
So what's your best guess?
My recollection, Your Honor, is that the grievance in this matter was filed in 2004 And I know Mr. Eisenberg had brought up a claim, and he has not raised it on the appeal, but he did mention in the proceeding something about Attorney Rick, who was the counsel for the plaintiff, the defendant in the dog case, having submitted something when Mr. Eisenberg was up for a reinstatement in 2005. I didn't find any reference to it in the opinion on the reinstatement.
It seems to me, at least an argument exists, that this should have been included in the last proceeding that we were here on with Mr. Eisenberg, rather than now after he's been revoked since the conduct occurred a decade ago. It also seems to me that we might be getting into a dangerous precedent of revoking additional time after revocation. It's almost akin to when someone gets three life sentences, you know. I mean, how many? Isn't it a bit of overkill, I think, sometimes?
Well,
especially if they're consecutive. So I've got problems. Number one, why wasn't this brought with regard to the prior revocation? When we had all this stuff, why wasn't this consolidated with it? Number two, why should we start down a road where there is consecutive to revocation proceedings when, of course, the whole 25,000 is an issue, the system is geared up? Makes little sense to me. Why not save it if indeed you can't bring it previously? Why not save it until there is a request for revocation? So I've fired at you three questions, or a couple of questions. Let's see,
if I can take a crack at them, sure. Justice Bradley. As I said before, I was not there. I don't know what decisions were made as to what was sent to the Preliminary Review Committee at what particular point in time. The argument really was articulated, but not really well articulated in the brief by Mr. Eisenberg, and therefore I haven't really addressed it. I think it's a question of prosecutorial discretion. If this was a civil matter and we had claims between private clients and something arises out of a common nucleus of operative fact, we have claim preclusion. That sort of sounds like what the court is alluding to, but it's really something different here because it's not really the same thing. I think it's more akin to the situation of, you know, when you've got multiple crimes, you get a conviction for a life sentence, and prosecutorial discretion suggests at some point public resources should not be expended further, but that's a matter of discretion, not a matter of a bright line rule that would preclude the prosecution from bringing an action, provided statute of limitations hasn't expired, of course, on a separate wrongful act. So yeah, that's my response on that, Your Honor. And in terms of the extension thing, I let me enlarge on, I think, the question that was asked by Justice Prosser, which was, given the passion with which Mr. Eisenberg says, take my license, why are we here defending this case? The OLR would have been more than happy to have had this case go through on a default. I'm sure if there's something called a petition for revocation that's out there, Mr. Eisenberg, if he didn't want these cases to go forward, could have filed something along the lines of a petition for revocation, saying I can't defend these allegations, whether there's nine more in the pipeline that haven't been filed, and who knows what's going to happen to those. There's a way to do that. What he did in this case was he defended. He defended tooth and nail. He forced us to go through the process of proving up these claims. The second set of claims, the fourth and fifth claims in this case, did not arise until 2007. And I think that was the previous case in which I was before the court that resulted in the revocation. I think it may have actually been commenced at or about the time of the events in that workers' comp proceeding. So I think counts 4 and 5 are not affected by the same concerns that the court may have about dealing with grievances based on facts going back to 2001 and 2002.
Do you think you're going to get $25,000 plus out of Mr. Eisenberg if you prevail?
I mean, does he have $25,000?
Yeah.
Well, I think I'd like to address the record on that because Mr. Eisenberg has claimed that all of these proceedings, including the frivolous proceedings, have impoverished him, yet in his divorce case, which the court could take judicial notice of if it wanted to, it's disclosed that the $150,000 sanctions from the previous case were paid by a trust set up by his mother. Those were not paid by Mr. Eisenberg. Now, whether or not he has any assets in his own name, I have no idea. That would require an analysis of what the record was in his divorce case. It may well be that other than the ability to tap into this trust, he may not be collectible, and based on the judicial decision that the Court of Appeals rendered in this case, that trust is probably not reachable for the costs.
Well, I think I'm going over some of the same ground that Justice Bradley has gone over, but Alan Eisenberg's license to practice law has been revoked. I don't think there's anyone in this room who would want to bet very much money that if he applied for reinstatement, he would succeed. And yet, he's basically saying, you're going after, you're trying to beat a dead horse, and you'll never be able to collect the money. And if you're never able to collect the money, members of the court and you and any other attorney in the room and all the members of the bar are going to make up the cost of this prosecution. Now, give me a really good reason why you're doing that.
I think the reason for that, Justice Prosser, is that the lawyer disciplinary system was set up to protect the public. Members of the public come to the OLR in good faith with grievances against attorneys who they feel have committed wrongful acts.
Yeah, but he's revoked. He's revoked, and every month we get statistical reports that there's so many cases pending in front of the Office of Lawyer Regulation that are not completed. So, I mean, here you are, one of the most skilled and well-known advocates for the Office of Lawyer Regulation. Is this the highest and best use of your time, counsel?
In my opinion, frankly, I would tell all the justices of this court, I would have liked to have seen these proceedings resolved in a more efficient fashion without having to necessitate the 53-page report by referee Decker.
So are you representing to the court that it is his fault that these matters were not resolved in a more timely way?
Well, Mr. Eisenberg certainly never approached us and offered to confess to these charges. He fought them tooth and nail. You know, he says, take my license. I don't care. I don't want to be a lawyer anymore. Yet he, at the same time, says, I didn't do anything wrong, and I want justice. And I think the referee's report in this case displays outrage at the manner in which this case was defended, whether that contributed to his decision saying we ought to extend this for 2 years rather than 6 months, I can't say. I know referee Decker cited a number of cases treating this case as if it was a filed case without the revocation component built into it. I recognize that there's a policy concern that the court has about the allocation of resources and what ought to be done. As I'm retained counsel, I get these cases after they come through a long process. There's an investigative process. They go to the preliminary review committee. The director ultimately makes the decision, do we prosecute this case? Do we do something else with this? I don't know what the something else would be. I think there is a concern that if you just sit on these things forever and then someone does apply for reinstatement, are we now dealing with things that are beyond a 10-year statute of limitations and suddenly they've just gone away?
Well,
that's the most I think I can say on that subject.
There's a problem in terms of deciding when to move forward on a prosecution and when to wait for additional grievances come through. If you check OLR, you will find that sometimes they wait and that a matter is held for a significant amount of time waiting for the investigation on the second and third and fourth complaints. Then they're packaged together, and it's been quite a long time. Okay. Other times they proceed on the first two or three complaints, going forward with the others at the same time or a little later, just so otherwise the person can be continuing practice for several years before the fourth or fifth grievance is finished.
That is a problem, Your Honor, and I just had a file come into my office where I actually filed two complaints on the same day recently. One of them was a 39-count complaint involving 10 grievances with over 300 paragraphs. It's a monstrosity. If it's contested, it's going to be a challenge to manage a case like that, too. And that's another concern with having to consolidate grievances into a single proceeding. It becomes unmanageable at some point.
Well, I mean, these are discretionary choices, and they may be correct, they may be incorrect. If there was an application for reinstatement, I don't know that the OLR can then bring forth grievances that weren't proved up. So I don't know what the answer to all this, and I would check on the dates, and I'm not so sure that there's full coinciding here, but I'd have to check that. What about the costs?
Well, the costs, Your Honor, were reasonably and necessarily incurred in the prosecution of this case. We had a trial that extended over a number of days. We had a full day initially.
Did Mr. Eisenberg cross-examine your witnesses?
I didn't quite make that out, Your Honor.
Did he cross-examine your witnesses?
Yes, he certainly did. He spent a great deal of time cross-examining witnesses.
Did he bring in witnesses?
He did bring in several witnesses as well as testifying on his own.
Cross-examine them?
Yes, we did, Your Honor. We had a transcript of approximately 400 pages. There were motions filed. Mr. Weisenberg filed a motion to dismiss based on selective prosecution. He filed the motion to recuse the referee. All of that necessitated a briefing and ultimately a decision by this court on the recusal issue.
We concentrated on the dog issue, but I want to move to the workers' comp issue for a moment. And there the grievance is fee splitting. Is that right?
Yes. Well, that's count four.
Pardon me?
Count four.
And over the years, I think the code on fee splitting has changed over the years. And on the basis of my past experience of being on the BAPR board, doing some review as the Chief Justice, I think there's a lot of fee splitting out there. Maybe dressed up in a whole variety of ways, but I think that lawyers have cases. They may not want to handle them. They may not think they're competent to handle them. They don't want to handle them. And they give them to another lawyer, and an arrangement is made for compensation, even if the only thing transferred was the name, address, and etc. What do you think?
Well, the fee splitting here was of a little different character. It was with a non-lawyer.
I understand that. What about fee splitting generally?
In fee splitting generally?
Yeah.
I think the objective here has to always be what serves the public the best. Mm-hmm. What method gets them the best legal services? Mm-hmm. What gets them to the most qualified lawyer? I think over the years the court has certainly in the 30 years I've been in practice, there used to be a rule that it was pretty much you couldn't fee split unless you actually did some work on the file and allocated it on an hourly basis. That has changed clearly.
That's right.
And I think there is a good public policy behind that, because it does help assure that a client is best served by an attorney who's experienced and competent in that area. I know that was before the court. Recently, we had a 5-2 decision on fee splitting involving a bonus issue with a paralegal, where the court, I think, again, was moving more toward a recognition of maybe the traditional anti-fee splitting
right.
rule was too absolute. Mm-hmm. In this context, I think what the referee did was he analyzed the fee splitting here and concluded it didn't comply with the workers' compensation code, and therefore was still problematic.
This is just a different form of the old traditional ambulance chaser that the lawyer gave somebody who knew about an accident a fee for dropping that lawyer's card or recommending that lawyer. Non-lawyer fee splitting.
That appears to be what was potentially going on here, that there was a physician that was working with a patient on a workers' comp matter. The lawyer, whether it was Mr. Eisenberg or his predecessor, I suspect may have done the filings and signed the filings, but it may well have been the doctor that was doing most of the substantive work.
Because although the doctor could appear and help the person, not when it got to an administrative law judge.
That's correct.
Then you needed a lawyer.
That's correct. That's the type of fee splitting that was going on here. And then, of course, count 5 dealt with the misrepresentations by Mr. Eisenberg to the OLR when he denied having an agreement. And I think the evidence in support of that claim is very well laid out in the report as well as in the briefs. I mean, it's very clear Mr. Eisenberg told the OLR repeatedly that he had not, the letter that ended up with the administrative law judge, that it hadn't gotten there, that he hadn't signed it, that he had ripped it up. Yet, lo and behold, on the day of the hearing, the original ink-signed letter was produced after approximately a half hour or 45 minutes of objections by Mr. Eisenberg to the evidentiary basis of getting the original document in. It was finally admitted into evidence, and that was the original ink-signed document that the referee relied upon in concluding that Mr. Eisenberg had misrepresented to the OLR that that letter had never been sent. So that's count 5. I think in terms of the appeal here today, I came prepared to argue on standards of review. The standards of review really have not been addressed by Mr. Eisenberg in this case. It's the focus of his argument here today, as well as his brief, I think, focuses on, at best, on other policy issues, going to the larger question of whether or not the OLR should be expending resources prosecuting an attorney who's already been revoked. That's the issue I see presented here today, rather than an attack on the findings of fact, the conclusions of law. There is, to some extent, an attack on the recommendation, but I think it's based primarily on the argument, I'm already revoked, why are we extending that period? And
with regard to that argument, before you adjust and go to standard of review, one of the comments advanced today was, take my license. Under 22.19, there is a provision for consensual license revocation. But one of the provisions requires that in order to do that, The petitioner shall state that the petitioner cannot successfully defend against the allegations of misconduct. What's your understanding, if you have one, as to whether or not there has been any position taken by the petitioner with regard to successfully defending against the allegations of misconduct that may be pending?
Well, I think that's one of the problems in this case, is Mr. Eisenberg did defend. I mean, he, and we had a similar problem with the Weigel case that I was on here before the court approximately a month ago, where Mr. Weigel had filed a petition for a voluntary revocation. The OLR responded with some conditions on it, and one of the problems was Mr. Weigel did not want to admit he could not successfully defend some of those allegations, which were at that time the subject of an investigation, and therefore we ended up having to go forward on that matter as well. And I think that whether there's a way for somebody to say I cannot successfully defend the allegations because I don't have the money to be able to afford to do it, I think that's part of the problem with the rule. I think the message that the OLR has carried around, at least as I understand it, is that the court frowns upon the appearance of plea bargaining, and if someone was to file a petition saying I can't defend because I can't afford to defend, I still deny it on the merits, would that type of petition be accepted by the court? Based on what I understand is the antipathy toward plea bargaining, my suspicion is it wouldn't be. And as I said, Mr. Eisenberg denied all of these allegations. He denied them. We went through a trial. We briefed these allegations post-trial. And he's appealed all of them. He still says they're de minimis and they should be dismissed. So here we are. But in terms of the standards of review, of course, the court is familiar with those. The findings of fact are affirmed unless they're clearly erroneous. Mr. Eisenberg hasn't identified any findings and argued that they're clearly erroneous. The conclusions of law are independently reviewed. The only attack on the conclusions that I've seen in the brief or heard here today is that these are de minimis. That's the only argument that was advanced. The primary argument here seems to be attacking the referee, attacking the OLR, attacking the OLR director, attacking me. That was clearly done at trial also, and I think that's reflected both in the transcript as well as in the referee's report. Mr. Eisenberg, I think at one point said that he had been, that there had been hundreds of grievances brought by them. He doesn't identify who the them is. He claims he describes himself as a scapegoat. He doesn't say a scapegoat for whom. The purpose of attorney discipline is to protect the public. The repetition of misconduct by Mr. Eisenberg indicates that the public hasn't been protected and the public is in need of protection. This is a repeat. The dog case in particular is another case of frivolous and abusive litigation. Secondary purpose is to, I call it the education purpose, to impress upon the attorney the seriousness of the misconduct. The fact that it keeps recurring indicates that the message isn't getting through. It's not sinking in. Mr. Eisenberg is still stubbornly denying any wrongdoing. There's a purpose of deterrence and sending a message to attorneys not to commit similar misconduct. And I think the two grievances here dealing with frivolous litigation as well as fee splitting, and I think more importantly, the misrepresentations to the OLR are both serious matters on their own. The grievances here were not initiated by OLR. These grievances were brought to OLR by, in the first instance, it was a private citizen, the victim of frivolous litigation, and by her attorney. This was not something that was initiated by the OLR. This is not the product of the OLR being on a witch hunt against Mr. Eisenberg. The other grievance came to OLR's attention only because there was another grievance already pending before the OLR with respect to the fee splitting in that case. So again, it was the OLR did not go out looking for that situation. It came to them from appropriate sources. The Sanford grievance, I think the referee's report lays out very well the overwhelming evidence in support of the conclusion that this action was frivolous, and Mr. Eisenberg knew it was frivolous from the outset. He details the numerous and conflicting stories Mr. Eisenberg tells about the basis for that case. The second count dealing with the conduct during the deposition, I think, again, is very well supported by the record, the transcript of the deposition itself, as well as by the testimony of Attorney Rick, which the referee adopted and found to be believable. And the court affirms those findings on review unless they're clearly erroneous. The third count, the failure to comply with the court order requiring the payment of sanctions. The record shows that there was a four-year gap between the time the order was entered and the time Mr. Eisenberg moved. After one unsuccessful appeal, he went and moved to reopen 4 years later. And I think the referee has cited the appropriate case law in support of that. I've talked about the workers' comp case, and I think with those comments I'd conclude with, again, the OLR's request in this matter is that the extension of the ineligibility period be extended for at least 6 months, and that Mr. Eisenberg be assessed the cost of this proceeding because he did defend this case, necessitating that it go forward.
Counselor, these matters have been brought before us. Do you know of any other disciplinary matter where the court agreed with the findings and conclusions that have been presented to it, but withheld a dispositional conclusion until some time in the future?
I'm not aware of any, but again, I'm not at the OLR. I'm sure the folks at OLR would know if there were such occasions. I'm not aware of one.
Are you aware of anything in the Supreme Court rules with which you've dealt in your experience that would preclude the court from making a decision on disposition in this matter?
I'm not aware of anything that would preclude the court from doing so, and I think ultimately, given the court's constitutional authority in this area, the court can do pretty much what it feels is appropriate.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Eisenberg, microphone will be moved.
With respect to the last issue raised by the court, specifically when finding out they would not allow me to surrender my license unless I confessed to 9 more that I had already defended, and upon learning that if I ever applied for a license again, they were going to start, even if it was when I reached 100 years old.
But, Counselor, my question was not focused on that. My question was focused on whether the court, if it accepted the OLR's findings and conclusions, could withhold its disposition on this matter until some time in the
future. That's what I'm getting to. I'm addressing that. I specifically asked OLR if they would do that. On the one hand, you say that if I apply for a license again, even if I'm 100 years old, you're going to come forward with 9 more. That I said, then why don't you withhold any disposition on the matters you just tried me on, including the cost, until such time as I reapply? I specifically asked that.
I thought it was conditioned on OLR saying to you that you had to admit culpability for the charged offenses. And I think OLR's attorney said pretty much the same thing.
No, they had not been charged. They said they would wait until I reapplied.
I'm just talking about the matters before us, Mr. Eisenberg.
Oh, okay.
I'm not talking about something that I haven't seen. I have nothing to base any inquiry on there.
I asked them if they would hold up on the matters before us today until such time as I reapplied, which I've already told you is going to be never. I'm going to die first. So I'm trying to agree with you.
Okay, fine. Thank you. I understand.
I did ask for them to withhold any imposition on the matters pending before us until such time as I reapplied. Just a couple of short points. I was characterized as defending this matter tooth and nail. I thought that I was being attacked tooth and nail, and I thought it was a witch hunt. So I guess it's an issue of whose ox is being gored. This business of fee splitting with the doctor, the case was originally the doctor's case. He let me know so in no uncertain terms. A clear record was made on this. I begged OLR to bring in the doctor to testify, who would have been the most important witness. They refused. I could not. On the matter which I was accused of fee splitting, I didn't realize that I had issued such a document. I really didn't realize it. I asked him to draft something that was fair. This is in the record. And I signed what he drafted. And when I realized what he had drafted, I immediately withdrew it. So that was certainly a mistake on my part, not doing all of that carefully enough. But what he's not telling you and can't tell you is the way it all ended up. The doctor wound up getting 98% of the fees because he had done 98% of the work. So there was no fee split. I offered to tender 100% of all of my fee records and distributions to OLR to audit them to see if I had ever split a fee in my 50 years. They refused. I never split a fee with anybody in my life. Not ever, except the lawyer. And only when it was well justified. When asked, why did you do things in this way, he said, I'm retained counsel. He's saying, I was just following orders. That's what Adolf Hitler's subordinate said. I was just following orders. Well, I don't think that's ethical. And then he says, the referee's report displays outrage. Judges' reports, judicial decisions should not display outrage or rage. They should be fair and just. I didn't understand that justice included referees' outrage. And as for this nonsense that I can afford $25,000 because I have a trust, I don't have a trust. It was my mother's trust. And it's a discretionary trust. And the trustee has not indicated any willingness to pay costs. None whatsoever. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Eisenberg. Thank you, Mr. Schwarzenbart. Discipline cases are always very difficult for the attorney. Counsel who represents the Office of Lawyer Regulation, and very difficult for the court. This concludes our hearing in 09AP284D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Alan D. Eisenberg. Justice Bradley will remain and talk with the class. My estimate is 20 minutes. Justice Bradley, is that enough time for you?
Sure. If they're available, I'll be happy.
Would that be satisfactory?
Am I excused, Chief Justice?
I'm sorry. Yes, you are. Both of you are excused. If you wish to listen to the discussion, you may, but it will not be on the substance of this case. The court will be in the conference room at 3. We have Right. Good. Thank you.